I'm Bill Littlefield. The NCAA tournament continues this weekend, and March Madness is the focus of this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests this time around are Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, Bill.
Thanks for having us.
Mike, I'm going to tap the ball off to you to start things off.
The ball is tipped, and there I am. So I'm speaking of cliches, NCAA tournament-specific cliches. One of them is the notion of survive in advance, which isn't a bad notion per se, but there is no reason that this took hold to the extent that every time there is a close game, some announcer has to intone, you know, the theme is to survive in advance. All you're doing is giving synonyms for win in a single elimination tournament, right? Proceed, draw nearer, move forward. This is not adding to the vast wealth of human knowledge. Second cliche is, and this is not so much a phrase as a conception, you know, you can't look at the tournament. It is a six-game tournament. You really should break it down into three mini tournaments, three weekends of tournaments. And this is mistaken for some great insight. Now, if you ask one of those coaches who's putting forward the break it down into mini tournaments, and you said to him, so when you play the first game, you're acknowledging and looking ahead to the second game, they'd all say, no, we never look ahead to the game. So then what are you talking about? I think all they're saying is that when they pack their socks, they only pack for at most 4 days worth of trip. Mm. And then the last thing, I don't know if this is a cliche, but it fits in with the other two because it's a failure of conception or of innovation. In the NCAA, unlike the NBA, there is the one-in-one free throw. If you make one, you get to attempt a second one. Bizarrely, this only occurs after fouls, 7, 8, or 9, and if they're not shooting fouls. I mean, this is as complex as the tax code, but we're all used to them. And I just find it offensive that no coach notices this and fouls the other team's worst free throw shooter during the one-on-one situation. Because I've worked out the math, and if anyone touches the ball and they are less than a 66% free throw shooter, you can expect to hold the other team to less than 1 point per possession. That's something that almost every coach would take. But there is no innovation of going out and putting that other terrible free throw shooter on the line, and there should be. Because it's all about surviving and advancing, guys.
Well, I'm going to argue on behalf of cliches, because the NCAA tournament, I would say, is one of the few remaining shared experiences across this divided nation of ours. And we have to rely on tournament commentators to be reliable guardians and shepherds for our national cliches. Mm-hmm. So Sweet 16, Elite Eight, March Madness. Aren't these kind of comforting terms that we can retreat to when we're tired of politics and fighting with everyone on Twitter? I kind of like that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to argue against you on this, and it's because of something that Mike said. I really want to hear an announcer on network TV say, Gonzaga has drawn nearer to the championship. I just think that would be wonderful. And Mike, as far as I'm concerned, you have my vote as the next president of the NCAA. And when you take office, please also address the fact that the University of Washington women and the University of Connecticut women are both called the Huskies. And if they ever have to play each other in an important game, the confusion would be intolerable. And I leave it to you to settle that as well.
Well, this is similar to, say, Kentucky against Kansas State, that wildcat on wildcat violence that we've all come to love.
This is a common problem, Bill. We are not going to solve this one overnight.
Rachel, it's your turn.
Well, Michigan's NCAA tournament run ended with a loss to Oregon in the Sweet 16 on Thursday night, but the Wolverines still went farther than most people expected, and there could be a strange contributing factor, their near-death experience. Just before the postseason, the team plane malfunctioned on takeoff and nearly skidded into a ravine. Players and support staff evacuated the plane and everyone was okay, but the players were so terrified they actually held a vote on whether to get back on the plane, another plane, of course, to the Big Ten Conference tournament. Mm-hmm. They voted yes, and Michigan won that tournament despite being a middle-of-the-pack team basically all season. A recent study at the University of Arizona found that basketball players who were asked questions about their own impending deaths scored more points than players in a control group who were asked only about basketball. Researchers say that the performance boost comes from a subconscious effort to boost your own self-esteem, which protects you from a fear of death. So I ask you guys, do you think that Michigan's scare just before the postseason fueled its overachievement, or was this just a case of an already improving team going on a hot streak?
Mike, I can't wait to hear what you have to say about this theory of motivation.
Well, if you want to talk about cliches, they say, you know, you got to leave it all out there on the floor. So you have to play like there's no tomorrow. And with the fear of death, there would be.
There isn't.
Furthermore, these researchers from the University of Arizona, if only they had put a little shock into the Wildcats in their game against Xavier, blowing a giant lead with 7 minutes left. If they could just take aside Sean Miller and say, you know, if you lose, I don't want to say anything, but you might have to die. I mean, maybe they'd make a Final Four. I don't know.
Well, I always root for the story and the possibility that being reminded of one's mortality improves one's shooting percentage is certainly a great story. Great stuff. As long as some coach doesn't decide that he can motivate his team by orchestrating a bus accident or hiring somebody to pretend to poison the training meal, I'm all for this. I'll go with this story. Rachel, you can wrap it up for us.
Well, yeah, I think there is a danger given the short career spans of some coaches some shenanigans like that.
All right. I want to broaden the conversation a little bit, get beyond basketball. In a long article for The Undefeated, Tom Farry has demonstrated that Division I colleges have been accepting fewer and fewer athletes who are the first person in their family to go to college. A lot of reasons. Higher academic standards dissuade coaches from signing players coming from said families because they're afraid they might not be able to keep them eligible. UConn men's basketball team, for example, missed the whole postseason because of academic problems. Second reason, coaches these days tend to recruit kids who play organized sports from an early age, and those sports cost a lot of money. And a lot of families with nobody who's ever gone to college don't have a lot of money. The conclusion here is that playing basketball or football very well as a child and then as an adolescent perhaps isn't such a sure route to a college scholarship as the NCAA has led some people to believe. And maybe the whole system is more seriously broken than I had previously assumed. Rachel, what do you think?
Well, this actually has been an issue for quite a long time. I wrote a series about high school football in Oregon several years ago about the fact that teams at wealthier schools were winning a disproportionate share of state titles. And you look across the country and things like that are happening more and more. I think that speaks to the number of things that you can buy that can help improve your performance, things like summer camps and private coaching and better coaches for your school. There's also been, in a lot of cases, a decline in public funding for public school activities, including sports, mm-hmm. which in turn tends to make teams worse and tends to encourage great players to go to places where there's more funding for sports.
I would think that being the first person to go to college in your family is a loose correlation to just general destitution and privation. And the old idea about sports being the way to rescue you from that, that's being challenged more and more. So as you say, the professionalization of youth sports, or think about every NFL quarterback, they always have a private coach. They've, you know, frequently have a father who was either in the NFL or really a accomplished, which gives you resources and genes and also put you in the pipeline. But one of the central tenets of the Blind Side was that we tend to think if someone shows an athletic prowess or even athletic promise, like the central character of that book did, he'll be plucked up by our sports industrial complex. And it's just not the case. It's just another barrier that we are told is an equal playing field, and it's not.
No, in fact, Michael Orr was essentially adopted by a very wealthy family, and that was mm-hmm. the route by which he had a pro career. This problem is obviously one part of a much larger issue, which is the hideously unfair distribution of income. People without money, family with no history of higher education, sometimes can't afford fees for school sports, let alone extra fees for club sports, travel teams, etc. I would talk at length about how to solve these particular problems, but my goodness, we're out of time. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Bill. Good luck on your bracket.